This is Matt Dunlap filling in for V. Paul Reynolds as part of the normal rotation in the winter months, which now are over. Winter is over, and I'm joined in the studio by none other than Jim Layton, our engineer and co-host for the show. Good evening, Jim.
Well, good evening, Matt. Good evening, everybody. Welcome aboard.
And happy first day of spring, Jim.
Yes, thank you very much.
So we survived another winter. Now, that being said, we're still in ice fishing, so the derbies are pretty much behind us. There is that one statewide one that's going to continue to go on for a while, at least until the end of the month. But check that ice if you are up north. There's still a lot of good ice up north. Make sure you keep an eye on things, especially around, you know, the outlets near the edge of the shore, that sort of thing. And keep an eye on your ice shack. And those have got to be off the ice by either ice out or within 3 days of the close of the season, whichever is earlier. And the season ends in about 11 days. On the 31st of this month, ice fishing will end, and we'll get into open water fishing. And a lot of open water, at least in central and southern Maine already, it's coming up north. And so there's a great feature on the Fish and Wildlife, a couple of great features on the Fish and Wildlife Department website. We encourage you to take a look at. And by the way, we're right in the middle of it, Jim. We're in Outdoor Digest right now, which is brought to us each and every week by our good friends of the Northwoods Sporting Journal, which happens to be my favorite outdoor publications. I forgot to even say hello to everybody. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Maine Outdoors. If you do, in fact, like to hunt, fish, trap, snowmobile, camp, bike, hike, birdwatch, snowshoe, or do anything in the Maine outdoors, this is the show for you. And in this hour, Jim Layton and I, along with our special telephone guest tonight, and you, will explore the Maine outdoors. If you would like to participate, the number to call is 1-800-966-1039, toll-free all over the state of Maine. So now that I've caught back up to where we're supposed to be, we're in Outdoor Digest, and those are some of the goings-on around Maine and the outdoors. Penobscot Fly Fishers had their cabin fever reliever here a couple of weeks ago, and all accounts were it was a great event. And haven't been really any other sportsman shows this particular spring simply because we're still fighting the pandemic, although it does seem to be. There we go. I'm getting red, rich, and Flint River paid. Fishing, loving every day. That's our Outdoor Digest music brought to you by Jim Layton. We're going to get this all straightened around. Don't you worry, folks. So, the sportsman shows have been largely shelved. In fact, I was looking at my program notes from last year. We're talking about how the Presque Isle Fishing Game Show had been pushed off till this weekend this year, and they've pushed it off, I think, until next weekend next year. So hopefully we can get out of this and get back to some of the sportsman shows. And along that line, folks, you know, it's bad enough to miss the shows, but think about the organizations that put those shows on, great organizations like the Penobscot County Conservation Association, the Presque Isle Fishing Game Club, Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, which has their show coming up soon. They are having their show. In fact, they've been advertising it. They use these shows as fundraisers to do an awful lot of good things, and the inability to have some of these fundraisers has really put a crimp in the plans for a lot of these conservation organizations. So it wouldn't hurt you at all to, you know, maybe spend a few extra dollars and join one of these organizations, help them out a little bit as they do their work. So something to check out in your local area, your local fishing game club, some of the statewide organizations like the Bowhunters Association, the Atlantic Salmon Federation, as well as some of the professional organizations like the Maine Professional Guides Association and some others. Check those out. I know that we've had our own struggles with the Maine Youth Fishing Game Association, and we're still looking at putting on summer camps for the kids this summer. And it's going to be a little bit tight, Jim, but we're going to try to get it done. So back to the outdoors, and for your own part, we're getting into the season, and for folks who think about outdoor activities, including things like sitting by the fire with a warm cup of coffee, and you don't do a lot of ice fishing or snowmobiling, and don't forget to get your license before you get out there fishing. And get right online at maine.gov/IFW, and you can get your license within about 5 minutes. It's pretty slick and easy how they do it. And along that line, people always laugh at me this time of year when I issue this little call of warning. Don't forget the Moose Lottery. It's due at midnight on May 12th, and that seems like an awful long time away. And when I was in a position to take these types of phone calls, usually it'd be the day after the lottery closed that I have all these anguished inquiries like, oh, is there any way I can get my thing in now? It's like, no, deadlines are deadlines, and that's it. So if you've been in for a few years and you miss it, you're going to lose all your points. So don't forget to get that in, for goodness sake. So how are things out to Fields Pond there, Jimmy?
Well, I'll tell you, the ice is starting to turn black, and there was an otter come up through the ice in front of our place today.
No kidding.
Had to eat a few, had his breakfast, eating fish.
Yeah, yeah.
But the ice is getting really shaky out there now.
Yeah, I noticed down in Augusta, it was all out of the Kennebec River. So the river was frozen right across on Friday, and then Monday it was wide open. So
yeah. We do have open water in some spots.
Yeah, no, northern part of Old Town, there's still ice across the river, but I think that's not long.
Yeah, there's your junky junk streams all open.
Yeah.
Going out of Fields Pond.
Yeah, so it's the ice is moving out fast. Yep. So
ducks are back.
The ducks are back. I've seen sure a lot of ducks. I've seen a lot of robins, which it seems early for robins. And, of course, everybody's being serenaded all day long by cardinals. Cardinals are out there singing. Trying to get themselves set up.
Red-winged blackbirds are back. That's springtime for me.
Yeah, they are back. So it looks like we have survived another winter. So I think we're going to wrap that up, Jim, unless you have something else going on that I don't know about.
Nope, just wanted to shout out to Lorraine, my cousin, who always listens from way down in Hartford, Maine.
Nice. Well, good evening, Lorraine. Good to have you with us by the radio, and all of you for tuning in. Those of you who are not watching basketball right now.
Yeah.
So,
and I know Hunter's listening.
Oh, yes. A lot of people are listening. Yep. So, you know, say good evening to all of them. So that wraps up Outdoor Digest for this week's edition, which is brought to us, as it is every week, by our good friends at the Northwoods Sporting Journal, my favorite outdoor publication. So we're going to take a little break. But before we do, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we have on tap for us tonight. We're going to have calling in Ron Fournier, and Ron Fournier is an old friend of this show. He's been on a number of times in previous capacities as director at Bryant Pond and Greenland Point, the summer camps there. Now he is the recreational safety coordinator for the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, a job that was held for many, many years by my good friend Mike Sawyer, who finally retired. And now Ron Fournier is in that role, and he's going to talk to us about a couple of innovations that are going on with some of the safety education programs that they are offering up. And we're going to have him on in a little bit. But before we do, we're going to take a quick break and something for you to think about, because we're going to have an outdoor trivia question. We're going to be giving away Maine Atlas and Gazetteer, courtesy of our good friends at the Old Town Trading Post. I went up there and I was going to buy something, and they said, "Oh no, take this for the radio show. This is great." So they're very generous in the community. They're huge supporters of youth in the outdoors and some of the outdoor organizations, including the Maine Youth Fishing Game Association. They're practically they're an anchor member of what makes our organization work. So we thank them for their generosity tonight. And so if you can answer this question, Jim, I bet you already know the answer because you're a smart man. So let me just frame it up for you. The beloved Atlantic salmon, which we haven't talked about in a while here, but the Atlantic salmon is known as an anadromous fish species. That is, it lives in the ocean, but it breeds and spawns in fresh water. A fish that lives in fresh water, but breeds and spawns in the ocean is called a catadromous fish species. Anadromous and catadromous. There's others, you know. If you want to get into your Latin compound words, you can have a field day in the field guides, but catadromous is what we're looking for. One notable species that we know a lot about in Maine is catadromous. What is it? If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 1-800-966-1039, and we'll be right back with a lot more in just a minute on Maine Outdoors. And if you're joining us late, this is Matt Dunlap along with Jim Layton on Maine Outdoors here on 103.9 WVOM. And our sister station is carrying this broadcast on 100,000 watts across the state of Maine. We appreciate you tuning in. We have a pending trivia question, and that is, We know about anadromous fish. That's like a mini brown trout and landlocked salmon. I'm sorry, not landlocked salmon, but sea-run Atlantic salmon are anadromous. They live in the ocean and breed in fresh water. But what about fish that live in fresh water but breed in the ocean? A catadromous fish. Can you name one? Do we have anybody standing by, Jim?
We do. Go ahead.
What's your name? Where are you calling from tonight?
I'm Jaden from Corinna.
All right. Jason, you say, or Jaden?
Jaden.
Jaden from Corinna. Jaden, do you think you know the answer to our question?
I think I might. The American eel.
Well, Jimmy, what do you think about that answer?
I think he's got it.
I think you do have it. Now, do you just know that, or did you look it up?
No, I knew it.
Oh, well, you know, good job. Sometimes I don't want to put out too much of a stumper on these, but this is the type of thing that I didn't think a lot of people would know off the top of their head. So I applaud you for that. Do you have anything you want to ask us tonight here on the air while we got you?
Nope.
All right, Jaden. Well, you stay on the line. Jimmy is going to get your name and address, and we're going to send you the main atlas and gazetteer courtesy of our friends at the Old Town Trading Post, so you can use that to track your adventures in the outdoors.
Awesome. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thank you. Do we have our guest on the line? Not yet. We're going to get our guest on the line. So in the meantime, Jim's going to take that information, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that are changing up a little bit. One of the things that we're probably not going to talk about tonight, but we are going to give you a briefing on it, and that is while we get Ron on the line. It's been in the papers that another proposal for Sunday hunting has been entertained by the legislature, and this is something that comes up every couple of years. It looks like it's not going to see an awful lot of traction on the floor of the House and the Senate. It was given a fairly lopsided ought-not-to-pass report out of the Fish and Wildlife Committee last week, a proposal that would allow small game hunting in northern Maine across a line that roughly would run up along Route 9 across the state. So this is yet another iteration of a Sunday hunting proposal that we've heard many times over the years. Sunday hunting was repealed, or actually prohibited to hunt on Sundays back in 1883. And I think the Bangor Daily News said that this is the 45th such proposal in the last 35 years to somehow modify that. It looks like it's not quite ready to go. I think part of the concerns that I heard about from folks was concerns about posted land and perhaps the ushering in of so-called fee hunting, where you'd have to pay a concession fee to hunt on somebody's land like they do in a lot of other states. So I think, you know, those concerns have kind of kept it from moving very far forward. We're one of a few handful of states that don't allow Sunday hunting, but we're also one of a few handful of states that allow what they call permissive trespass, where you don't necessarily need permission in writing to hunt on a woodlot or piece of land where you don't know who owns it, or one of those large pieces of land up north owned by one of the big timber companies. So it is what it is for now, and I know that some people will be disappointed about that, but I know a lot of landowners are probably breathing a sigh of relief that they don't have to deal with hunting 7 days a week on their properties. So that's the report on that. And we'll stand by here and wait for Ron Fournier to join us. Ron, we're going to get to know him a little bit tonight. So like I said before, people may remember him from when he was our guest talking about the youth activities at Greenland Point and Bryant Pond. He's been involved in outdoor education for many, many years, and he's going to tell us a little bit about that. And in the meantime, he's now taken a position as the recreational safety coordinator at the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And if you are short enough on the tooth that you've had to take a hunter safety education or a trapper safety education course or a bow hunting safety course, you know, you've had to take that through the department. And like the hunter safety courses are free, for example, all paid for by Pittman Robertson dollars, which is the excise tax that we pay on hunting equipment, and that is reallocated to the states sort of on a pro rata basis based on the number of hunting licenses we sell. And that's what makes those courses and all the materials that go along with them free of charge. And I know that there's been talk about moving some of that online to make it a little bit easier for people to access who don't have a lot of disposable time to get that sort of thing under their belts. And I think that's a pretty productive move if it's done right. And Ron's going to talk to us about that as well once we get him on the line. And in the meantime, you know, we are looking at all kinds of new ways to engage people in the outdoors. And I know that they are working very, very hard on that in the Fish and Wildlife Committee. And hopefully we'll see some innovative new things coming forward for that. So we are still waiting for he gave us a couple of different phone numbers, and I know Jim's trying hard to get hold of them. So we appreciate your patience as we try to reach our telephone guest here tonight. And he should be with us in just, I think we may have him now. So we're going to put him on the air and put him on the spot. And if you have a question about outdoor safety education or anything else to do with the Maine Outdoors, do feel free to call us at Maine Outdoors. Hello. Well, I think he just tried to call me on my cell phone. If you can hear me, why don't we take a quick commercial break and try to figure this out? Because I think we're having a problem. Well, welcome to live radio, folks. This is Matt Dunlap along with Jim Layton on Maine Outdoors. Jim, before your time on the show, there was an episode where I had Paul Johnson on the show. He was the fisheries biologist for Moosehead Lake, and he was talking about smelt, which was going to be a huge show. We expected the phones to ring off the hook, and it seemed awful quiet, and we're talking on the air, and I could hear the phone ringing in the lobby and just kept ringing and ringing and ringing. I finally passed him a note and said, keep talking. And I went out and answered the phone. It was one of the engineers. He said, you're not broadcasting.
Well, we are.
We are broadcasting, and we had a little bit of a snafu with the phones. We'll figure it out later on what happened. But we now have Ron Fournier on the phone with us. Ron, thank you for being patient and being persistent. We're happy to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Matt and Jim, and I appreciate your tactful stalling techniques. That was great. No stress here. I think we're all living in these very different times, and with technology and everything else, you know, you just sometimes you have to just punt. So it's all
yeah, good. You know, I first came on this show in 1997 as a new legislator and as a guest, and Paul and V. Paul and Wiggy Robinson were my hosts, and couple weeks later, Paul asked me, he said, oh, there's a snowstorm. Wiggy can't make it. Would you co-host? And I've been doing it ever since. And boy, we have some pretty funny stories about things that have gone wrong. But thankfully, this one's worked out. And now we have plenty of time to talk to you. And we're glad that you're on. Ron, tell us a little bit about your background in the outdoors and your work with young people and what's brought you to the position of recreational safety coordinator that you're in now at the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife.
Sure. You said we've got about 3 hours tonight.
Oh, anyway.
Oh, perfect. Excellent. So previously to starting with the department, I was the director of the Bryant Pond 4-H camp under the University of Maine in Bryant Pond, obviously. And I spent the last 15 years there, you know, working up through the ranks and whatnot. And then we took on Greenland Point in 2018, and I was kind of the director of both camps, kind of shuttling back and forth, working with a really dynamic team. And the mission was, you know, preserving the conservation education component of what was the Maine conservation school. So, you know, every day I woke up and put my boots on thinking about hunting and fishing and the outdoors and connecting youth as well as, you know, adult participants to, you know, meaningful activities and whatnot. And, you know, incidentally, it kind of led me to this next chapter in my life. I've been watching the position for the last couple of years. And in October, I started with the department as the recreational safety supervisor. So I oversee the team of recreational coordinators statewide. There used to be coordinators in each county, and we're actually broadening that to more regions. You know, Maine's a pretty large, small state, so we have a lot of ground to cover, and then they support all of the volunteer instructors statewide. I'm also a Master Maine guide, so I've been guiding for 15 years, so really, you know, it's kind of a perfect fit for me as far as taking my skills and my background to, you know, help these pursuits continue, and I have a lot of firsthand knowledge and, you know, through trial and error, like anybody that spends time outdoors, so I can apply all the lessons learned to this role.
It's really amazing how people get into these types of jobs. And, you know, if I started off the question by saying, did you ever think that you'd be doing this 20 years ago? I bet the answer would probably be no.
I don't know if I would have expected to be in this position here.
Yeah.
I left the kind of industrial world, being in a machine shop for a while, and my wife and four kids, we kind of took up a piece of ground in Mason Township on the western part of the state and built a little cabin and, you know, kind of the storybook beginnings of, you know, starting off in the mountains. And I kind of fell in love with, you know, guiding and working with people and sharing those types of things. But, you know, I think that in life you've got, you know, you've got one shot. So I keep saying it's all about the story. And just make sure that your work is meaningful and impactful and that, you know, fills your cup. So, yeah, I'm happy to be where I'm at. And I think it was a perfect time, you know, in my life to take this on. We've got a lot going on. And the department's, you know, there's a lot of new initiatives and whatnot. So I couldn't have scripted this any better timing-wise.
You know, it's you know, just to give your work as a guide a plug, and I've said this on the show many times, and I've written about it many times. You know, growing up on a farm, you know, on the coast of Maine, you know, I was lucky. I had some mentors who taught me a lot of things about the outdoors. That's how I learned how to get into trapping. That was my introduction to the outdoors, was through dry land trapping for fox and raccoons, you know, I probably learned more about the outdoors in those years than I've learned in any other setting since. But the thing about that is that you get on a track and you learn a thing and you learn how to do that thing pretty well. One of the things I've tried to do now the last 20 years, every year I try at least once or twice to hire a guide to take me out to do something that I normally do by myself. And I have never been out when I didn't learn something brand new that I never had even thought about before. So it's you know, there's such a rich experience out there for folks that, you know, we sometimes say, I'm going to go hunting. Well, hunting for what and how are you going to do it? And you're hunting the same way your grandfather taught you to, but maybe there's another wrinkle that you hadn't thought of, and that's where a guide can come in. Because they, you know, out there, and a lot of the guides I know, you know, especially guys who hunt with dogs, I mean, they're out there, what, you know, probably 52 days a season, you know, during bird season, you know, running their dogs, and they see a lot of things and they get a lot of experiences they can pass on. So for a couple hundred bucks, you can learn something that you couldn't go to school for and learn. So it's a great thing to be able to do. And then kind of backtracking to your other work with Bryant Pond and Greenland Point, and I can tell you some of the stuff that we've seen at the Maine Youth Fish and Game Association. It's exactly the same thing. A lot of young people don't have the exposure to the outdoors that we did. You know, they don't have a parent or a grandparent to take them out or who has time to take them out. A lot of people work two jobs. A lot of, you know, couples, you know, in households work four jobs. A lot of, you know, single parents out there that don't have time or resources to do it. And that's where these programs really come into play. And I think that the department has recognized that with programs like Becoming an Outdoors Woman and some of the online classes that and safety classes they've been offered. It's not just the traditional, you know, how to, you know, get both legs over a fence without dropping your gun and accidentally shooting it. So what's going on with some of the, I know that you've been doing an awful lot to modernize some of the safety courses. Can you talk about that for a couple minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I like your point about trying something new, you know, hiring a guide or just really pushing your skills. And that's really what recreational safety is all about. It's about, you know, offering opportunities for folks to explore another activity and build off of that. And, you know, maybe you go into hunting and you're hunting waterfowl for years and you're really passionate about that, but you haven't tried turkey hunting or you haven't tried shooting a bow or trapping. And there's so many things to really delve into in Maine. And I just want to take 1 second. You know, if you look at the country, there's some beautiful places in this country here, but I think that it's really easy to take for granted the amazing state we live in. There's water literally around every corner for, you know, trapping and fishing and paddling. And there's just such a diverse landscape that we really are spoiled. And I don't ever sweat buying my hunting or fishing license ever. It's the best money I've spent all year. And so, you know, coming in, my first day on the job, my supervisor, Emily McCabe, met me at Federal Street. And I've been in and out of Federal Street in Michael Sawyer's office for years. I've been a volunteer instructor for 15 or 16 years and worked alongside Mike on all the things through camp. And, you know, it was an interesting emotion walking in that building and knowing that I'm at the helm here. And my first task was to clean Federal Street up, pack things up, and if it wasn't relevant, current, or useful, it's going to be archived, and we're moving forward to the new digs at 353 Water Street. So if you haven't been to the new headquarters, we're right on the river, right on the Kennebec. I got a beautiful corner office looking at the bridge and the river, and it's just a great space, really a wonderful layout as far as the way that the building is just flows and whatnot. And we're still moving in, really.
Well, for folks who may not know what you're talking about, you know, the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife for many, many years has had its headquarters on 284 State Street, right by the old Pat's Pizza, which is now closed, right within sight of the Capitol, right down the street. And actually, that was an old dairy. It was a creamery, believe it or not. It was never meant to be an office building, and it didn't really function very well as an office building, but they used it for I don't even know how many years as the headquarters of the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And of course, as part of the physical plant upgrades, they've moved downtown. And I have not seen it, but the word I've been getting is that it's a much better facility.
Yeah, it really works well. So, you know, after the first week or two of settling in, really got right to work. The first task was to reach out to all of the volunteer instructors, you know, and I think that looking back the last 2 years with COVID and you know, retirements and things like that, there was definitely a gap in time, and, you know, there was a lot of questions of what was going on, you know, with our safety programs, the volunteers needed anymore, and there's just a lot of, you know, unknowns. I connected with my team, met with all of them face-to-face, got to learn a little bit about them, and to try to gain some trust and get to know each other, and we dove right in, and we literally started looking at every single program and looking at it with fresh eyes and new perspectives. The number one thing is looking for barriers, anything that's preventing getting folks connected. And sometimes it can be as simple as an application or the way that a process has to happen, what we think has to happen, and trying to streamline some of those things. And then also recognizing places that were not visible. You know, not everybody in the state has internet or happens to be on social media. So looking at this from a very broad lens and trying to understand how do we reach every corner of the state and deliver the most, you know, meaningful and impactful programs. The coordinators work really hard with the volunteers to offer in-person hunter safety programs, bow hunter, crossbow. We oversee trapping, ATV, boating, and snowmobile. And we actually have a new safety course that's going to be unveiled very, very soon. I got some news that we'll be sharing this week, but it's the new bear trapping education class, which will be available online, but it'll also be in person for those that would like to attend in person. It's a shorter program, so it's not going to allow you to trap all fur bearers, but it's for folks that are maybe coming to Maine and want to hire a guide and hunt a bear with dogs or over bait, and then also trap bear. So it's a little bit of an easier process, but it's very focused on bear, the species, the natural habitat, and then the legal means and ethical take of black bear through trapping. So we're pretty excited about that. It's going to increase, hopefully, the harvest, you know, so we can help the biologists meeting our targeted harvest goals. And, you know, it's just an amazing resource to have black bears as prevalent as we do in Maine. And I think we may take that for granted. We don't necessarily see them all the time, but we have a really, really great resource here in Maine. The other thing we did is we started looking at trapper education. And historically, I took a look at the last 6 years, and we were averaging only 200 new folks going through trapper education annually. We had a high of like 258 and a low of like 171. And I was trying to figure out what was the stopgap. Why were we not reaching those folks? And we realized we needed to offer more classes more frequently, and we needed to offer them in all the nooks and crannies in the state. So we've really been working hard to offer more classes. We cover everything from landowner relations to ethics to, you know, regulated trapping and all the things it takes to be an ethical, legal, and safe trapper, and the benefits of conservation, helping our biologists out with, you know, biological data. Sometimes we're helping landowners. I've been trapping personally pretty heavily this year since November, and I worked with 5 different landowners, and everybody has been really appreciative of just helping with some beaver problems. They've had a lot of destruction, and, you know, we have to recognize that we're, you know, in the beaver's habitat, but there's ways of coexisting and maybe keeping the numbers to a manageable level. The trapping education programs are going to continue to be offered statewide in more frequency. And I think we've actually already certified over 300 in the last 4 or 5 months.
You know, that's actually, you make an excellent point, because, you know, like I said, I trapped as a kid, you know, and I had a really, really skilled trapper who was very ethical and showed me the right ways to do things. But, you know, because that was back in the mid-1970s, and I'd never, because that was before all the safety requirements were in place in law. And so I never got a trapping safety certificate. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll do that sometime. I'm not sure when I'd have time to do it, but get it behind me and keep it up. And then I would go online, and they might have one trapping course in the course of the summer, and it would be in Millinocket, for example. It would be way out of my way. So I was like, well, I'm not going to do that this year. So, you know, it sounds like, you know, that's being addressed in a very positive way. But, you know, let's get back to a little bit about why we have to do these safety courses in the first place, because that was not always so. I mean, this is I think the first one, if I remember, and maybe if Jerry Levine's listening, he can probably correct me, but I think the first safety requirements were in the mid-1980s, and that was just for hunting. And then the rest of it kind of was amended on later on, like bow hunting safety and obviously right. ATVs and everything. But it used to be, I mean, you know, you just go down to, you know, your local town office, and you'd pony up your money for the license, and you'd go down to the hardware store and pick up a 30-30, and you were hunting, right?
Right.
And yeah. We had a lot of problems back then.
Sure.
You know, and I remember, you know, reading about some of the statistics. Now, I think at the time, in the mid-1950s, we had about 100,000 licensed hunters who came to Maine or were in Maine or visited Maine to go hunting, and I think now we have about twice that number. It's a smaller percentage of the population, but it's a bigger raw number of hunters. So, I mean, I don't even remember, you know, really when the last time was we had a serious hunting incident where somebody was accidentally shot. It's been a couple of years. I think maybe somebody got hit with some birdshot this fall that I read in the paper, something like that. But, you know, in 1954, we had 18 fatalities out of 100 serious incidents, and that was the high watermark year. But that was very, very common, you know, mistaken for game incidents. And you know, as we examined this in the legislature, you know, there was a number of proposals to maybe water down the blaze orange requirement and to bring back the deer driving you know, methodology, which we did on a very limited scale, and bring back twilight hunting. And there's a lot to change very quickly. And I was very concerned that we were going to have absolute mayhem in the woods. And we didn't. And in just doing some further analysis, and this speaks to the importance of your work, Ron, you know,
yeah.
that was, you know, the real drive shaft on changing that entire dynamic was the hunter safety education. And I think a lot of guys laughed at it back in the 80s. It's like, oh, I've been in the woods my whole life. I don't need to take a safety class. But, you know, when I took it, because I wanted to know what it was all about, I mean, I grew up in the woods, and there was stuff that they taught that I had no idea about. So it's really, that's been a really, really important change in making hunting actually safer than crossing a road at twilight to get your mail.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Matt. You know, if you look back, and it was an evolution. The education, you know, as the years went on, and more folks had exposure to a core set of skills and kind of guidelines, the woods became safer and safer. And you know, there's always going to be an accident of some sort in some, you know, mechanism, whether it's snowmobiling or ATV or hunting, you know, capsizing a canoe, things like that. There's always risk. And these programs look at all of the different trends. We look at statistical data. The courses are fluid, so we have a standard curriculum, but we're always looking at what are the trends. Are we seeing an increase of turkey hunters? Do we need to increase the knowledge of that? Or I want to talk a little bit about the online opportunities, because it can be a little bit of a hot button with some folks. Looking back at the last 2 years of COVID and minimizing face-to-face, workshops and classes and things like that. Fortunately, there was some forward-thinking folks that really delved into the online opportunities for hunter safety, bow hunter, crossbow. And, I think it might have been a bitter pill for some folks to swallow initially, thinking that it wasn't going to be equitable. It was, how can you learn the same skills versus sitting in a classroom with an instructor and whatnot? And it was kind of a blessing that we had these opportunities, because for the 2 years of COVID restrictions, we would have lost basically a two-year gap or a generation of safety. And the numbers were staggering of how many folks actually took that online opportunity. It's comprehensive, and it really covers every single topic. You can't skip ahead. There's a lot to it. And I actually took all of the online courses myself, and I realized as an instructor, I've been teaching these, there were some things that I realized that those courses were covering that I needed to kind of, remember to bring back into the fold. And
let me just say this, folks. If you just tuned in and you're coming in late, this is Matt Dunlap along with Jim Layton on Maine Outdoors. We're talking to Ron Fournier, the recreational safety coordinator for the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. This segment of our show, Jim, is brought to us, as it is every week, by our good friends at General Appliance and Brewer. This is the place to go for your camp appliance needs, whether you're talking about gas lights, gas ranges, gas refrigerators, gas freezers, or the top-of-the-line composting toilets.
Ride the wave, baby.
Ride the wave. General Appliance at 91 Center Street in Brewer is your non-electric connection. It's a family-owned business that's been around since the 1920s. Now, they do close at night, so they haven't been open 24 hours a day since the 1920s. I mean, Al Elkin does deserve a break once in a while. He's found his niche in these changing energy times. General Appliance is there to serve camp owners with non-electric appliance needs. Now, just because you don't have a camp doesn't mean you can't, utilize Al's services. They service used propane appliances, and they sell parts for all makes and models, including the well-known Servel gas refrigerators. And as for those composting toilets, ladies and gentlemen, these are the wave of the future. In a conservation-minded world, totally reliable, odor-free. If you want to get a camp and Mama says, those outhouses are awful smelly, it's like, well, you've got this. This is
no mosquitoes either.
No mosquitoes. So if you have a troubleshooting question related to propane appliances, and they'll work on anything, by the way. They actually
electric, too.
Electric. They came to my house and fixed my dryer one time. So 989-3714, give Al a call or stop in for a visit. General Appliance and Brewer, the non-electric solution for camp owners throughout Maine. That's General Appliance, 91 Center Street in Brewer.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Brewer, Maine. Right across the river from the Queen City in Bangor.
You betcha.
So, Ron, you're talking about the online component, and I remember when people started talking about this and the absolute resistance to the idea that there's no way that people could learn safe firearms handling or some of the demonstration stuff that they do, but the reality is people do learn in different ways, and a lot of it's visual.
Sure.
Now, especially in this new day, I said this when I was first in the Office of Secretary of State, working with the folks at the Information Resource of Maine, who produced the Maine.gov website. It's like, you think about it, if there's a service that the state of Maine provides, people are going to want it online. They're not going to want to have to drive down to Water Street and pick up a license. They're going to want to be able to buy it online and print it off. And I think the same thing is now they're talking about, remote tagging online for things like turkeys and deer and whatnot. And this, I think, is just sort of a natural extension of that, don't you think?
Well, I think, the way we've been discussing this, openly with the public is it's one tool in our toolbox. So we completely understand that it's not for everybody. There's people that maybe they don't have good internet. There's also folks that can't sit in front of a screen and absorb that information without some kind of a hands-on, kind of tactile connection or being able to ask questions and whatnot. So it's one tool that we have in the toolbox. But just as a reference, last year alone, we had over 7,000 adults take hunter safety. Now, that doesn't even include bow hunter or crossbow. 7,000 adults combined with the probably a couple thousand in-person that took, you know, a workshop for hunter safety. And it was one of the safest years on record.
Yeah.
We had an amazing season. And nationally, the data does not support that it's any less safe than an in-person. And we've all been in an in-person class where you were really engaged and it was a great class. And then we've been in them where they weren't so great. Maybe instructors got off topic. So it's one tool we have. The in-person classes are not going away for all disciplines. We're going to continue with hunter safety, bow hunter, crossbow, all the trapping courses, as well as our riding courses for ATV, snowmobile, and boating. Those are going to continue, and that meets a different need. And there's some folks that are reaching out, and they're saying, I really want to be in the classroom. I want to be able to, you know, ask questions and whatnot. We also took, you know, when we look at the hunter safety online, the biggest thing that comes up is the firearms handling, safe gun handling. The state has two state ranges. We've got a really large amount of rod and gun clubs with ranges that people can get affiliated with and whatnot. But we actually just added three new modules on our website offerings, and it's called Firearms Fundamentals. And it's kind of, consider that as the next step. If you took a hunter safety or bow hunter and you wanted to continue on specific firearms knowledge, it's the same platform offered by Calcami. And there's a firearms pistol. There's a shotgun and a rifle. And it's everything from handling, setting them in, cleaning them, safe carry, and all that. So it's an extension of the program. But they're available right online there as well. The other thing I wanted to add is the ethics courses. So ethics courses, they're not as widely known, but, you know, people make mistakes.
That's not a bad thing, really.
Exactly. You know, I like to frame this as, you know, you might get a speeding ticket or spend a day in the principal's office, and, you know, people make mistakes. It shouldn't condemn you, you know, for the foreseeable future. And to explain it a little bit more, if somebody is charged with a violation of various degrees, whether it's, you know, criminal trespass or poaching a deer or baiting, things like that, they not only have a fine, they lose their license and privileges. And some of them, you'll actually lose your license for all of your hunting. So hunting, bow hunter, takes all that away. Your fishing. And you also can't register a snowmobile or ATV or boat. So, you know, it's kind of a stiff penalty for some of these as the deterrent to really be a safe, ethical, and lawful outdoors person. After 1 year, typically after 1 year, and some of the charges might be 3 years, you have to take a remedial ethics course. Traditionally, they were about 8 hours long. We had an outline where we had biologists and game wardens and a bunch of folks coming in and out and whatnot. And we looked at this, and we're really retooling and fleshing it out to be, I think, a little bit more current and effective. The goal is to really gain trust on both sides. We need to gain trust of the outdoors person, the violator, and they need to trust us a little bit and understand a little bit more about the department, the different divisions, and how things work with the Department of Inland Fisheries. And the goal is to really open up the conversation and to be able to listen and share, talk about landowner relations, ethics, you know, lawful issues and safety issues, and you know, gain that understanding of why these things exist. You know, if we didn't have these laws or policies or regulations, rather, you know, something is going to be affected, whether it's safety or, you know, conservation efforts, things like that.
Yeah, and I can remember, you know, talking to a school group about, you know, how the legislature works. And this one kid asked this very innocent question. He said, if you guys keep making laws, isn't everything going to be against the law someday? Which I thought was a really, really interesting question. And we started, you know, we talked about what law does, you know, and why, you know, sometimes laws permit things, sometimes they prohibit things, sometimes they allow things. But, you know, you get into that point of the outdoor ethics course. You know, I knew a guy who was out hunting. He shot a nice deer, is dragging it off the property. And a neighbor confronted him, you know, as to whether or not he actually had permission to hunt on this land. And it escalated and turned into a fist fight. And he was convicted of assault while hunting, you know, and he lost his privileges for some period of time. You know, so the laws are on the books. And if you read the the intent of laws going back to the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. I mean, it was kind of the Wild West out there, and the legislature started putting these laws in place to slow it down a little bit so that we wouldn't run out of deer, you know, wouldn't run out of moose, and came very close to running out of moose there in the 1930s. So, I mean, it's all about, you know, not only conservation, but maintaining, like you said, you know, relationships with landowners. And that's what the ethics piece is about, is like, why are these laws there? And they're there so that our grandkids can have a place to go hunting as well.
Exactly, exactly. You know, so when we look at this list of folks that need this ethics course, really the goal is, again, gain trust and get them back in the game, because not only are they sidelined and missing out on these opportunities, their families are. You know, likely they've got a child that, you know, when they ask if they can go out on youth day, and that parent has to say, well, I can't take you hunting because I can't legally hunt this year. You know, so we're trying to get folks back in the game and move forward. You know, it's all about, you know, kind of redemption. And I think that the folks that are going to participate in these are going to walk away with a much more positive outlook. And I'm actually looking forward to meeting some of these folks. I'm leading the first one on March 29th. And it's going to be kind of our initial kind of guinea pig session. We're gonna try some things, and we're going to work from there. So we're pretty excited about that. I know we're kind of getting a little tight on time here,
but
I want to cover...
We're within a minute, so talk like an auctioneer and get it all out there.
All right, excellent. I want to just have a moment to give a huge shout-out to the large team of volunteer instructors that for decades have been giving their time, their skills, their knowledge, and their passion for the outdoors. And, you know, many of them, we interact either on the phone or through the mail or online and whatnot. Some of them I meet face-to-face, you know. But these folks have given so much of themselves to keep these traditions alive and to help keep folks, you know, safe and on the right side of the law and whatnot. So we're going to be reinstituting some of our sessions where we can, you know, publicly thank folks and whatnot. But our volunteers, really, just a huge shout out statewide to anybody that's been a volunteer. We just thank you. You're really doing some great work. Work is not done.
Yeah, and we appreciate that shout out. We've been talking with Ron Fournier. We're out of time, Ron. We appreciate you taking some time out of your Sunday night to come on and talk with us. And we look forward to having you back on again to talk about some more of these programs. But until next week, we'll see you at that time at 7 o'clock on
Maine Outdoors.